Alright, so before we get into lesson five, I just wanted to make a short remark on the last question of lesson four. We kind of got to this Wednesday night, but really the time was pretty short once we got to that question, and so we kind of rushed through it. And so I just felt it might be helpful, even in light of what we're getting into today, to make a brief comment on that. The final question on lesson four was if relationships in the Garden of Eden were ideal, ordained by God, and the basis of Jesus' instruction, can we recreate these conditions? Is it possible? And again, one of the focuses of this class is to strive for the ideal. You know, do the best we can. And we want to do that in our marriages and in raising our children. And really, we should want to do that in everything, you know. It may not be possible to perfectly implement God's plan in marriage because we do fall short. But that does not change the fact that God's standards needs to be seen as basically achievable. I mean, we need to see them as a goal to reach to that God intends me to reach to. And so, as we think about the ideals that were established in the Garden of Eden, there are examples there, the way things had were to operate even before the fall, that we should, again, reach for, strive for the ideal. We are thankful to God for the grace that is found when we fall short, but the Word of God is revealed to us to help us not sin. And so as it depends on me, I am going to strive for the pattern that God has revealed to me. And so just wanted to make that remark before we got into class today. God's plan for marriage. All right, so as we prepare this class, I would like to give some of the goals or purposes of this class. We have marriage is about the glory of God, and marriage is meant to communicate God's plan and character. When we talk about marriage, we often talk about it in terms that are mostly self-centered, you know. And certainly God created marriage to meet man's needs. You know, it was not good that man was alone. Something was broken, or something was incomplete about the creation, and so God created Eve. And again, we talked about that Wednesday. But one point that I think is often missed as we think about marriage is what the right goal and purpose of marriage is from God's point of view. We will not accomplish what we need the most in marriage unless we have the right foundation. And if my sole focus in marriage is fulfilling my needs, and that is my number one pursuit, then I am probably missing what marriage is ultimately intended to be all about. And so that's kind of the premise for this class. And I hope that as we go through and again consider this again, that we will recognize that God is accomplishing much more in our marriages than just meeting some of the needs that I may have. Alright, so we're going to begin at the beginning once again. Genesis 1:1. Who would like to read that for us? We'll call on Julius. If you could read Genesis 1:1.
In the beginning, God created the heavens.
Yeah, and so we're coming back to this. Genesis 1:1. Everything, every created thing points back to God. You know, what we see, the relationships we have, you know, the universe that we're a part of, are all ultimately centered around God's glory. They are there to declare God's glory. And so that again is the basis and foundation of all relationships. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, we also have Genesis 1:26-31. We're going to read that once again. I think I have 26 through 28 up here on the board. But will someone read 26 through 31? Robert, could you read that for us?
And God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over everything that lives, that moves on the earth. Then God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the surface of the earth, and every tree which has fruit yielding seeds. It shall be food for you, and to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth which has life. I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day.
All right, so Wednesday we talked about the timing of marriage, and we noted that marriage was something that was created in the beginning on the sixth day. And, of course, in that discussion we talked a lot about the first question of this lesson. But what is special about the creation of man?
Created in God's image.
We come back to that, right? We come back to male and female, he created them. And so the concluding crowning point of creation was man and woman. This was a pinnacle of God's creative work. And again, the premise, all that was created was ultimately created for the glory of God, is perhaps more true about man and woman than anything else in God's creation. Man has the ability not to just reflect the glory of God, but also to reflect the image of God. And so, in mankind is a potential to have the most clear demonstration of God's power, God's knowledge, God's mind, and God's glory shown in this part of his creation. And so, again, we talked about the image of God some. And we noted that what we mean by the image of God is not that we are duplicates of God, right? We're not God ourselves. However, there is a resemblance and likeness to God that man and woman has. There are capabilities that we have because we are created in the image of God, just like God has. We have the opportunity to love and hate. We have the capability of choosing and, again, making choices that are not merely a reflection of my instinct. You know, God tells us to be holy as he is holy. He never tells the animals to do that. That's because there's a different quality about man that that is different and exalted above the rest of God's creation. And so we were created in the image of God, male and female. He created us. Now, the second question in our worksheet is, does marriage have anything to do with God's image? Do you see a connection in Genesis 1? How did you answer that question?
They're both created by God. Mm-hmm.
All right. Both created by God to bring glory to him. Carl?
And I think that it's through marriage, right? And you know, male incomplete, female incomplete, but male and female together, that life is created and is procreated, and that commandment of God can be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean that commandment, that last commandment in there about be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Yeah, it can happen without marriage, but not in a way that's actually good for us.
And so we have, again, the way that God is going to fill his earth, again, with what? His image, right? And so it is by marriage that God intended to fill the earth again with His image. That was His intention. And so what we have in
And let's say this too, that you know, God is a relational being.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, and He even sits there and talks about, let us make man in our image, and we can talk about what exactly that means. But then God didn't make us to be isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And solitary, right? We're more fully in the image of God when we are in close relation with others, and the closest relation that God intended for that is marriage. It's not the only one. There are others.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other relationships also reflect the image of God, but that one is different.
Mm-hmm. And so when you have a male made in the image of God joining himself to a female made in the image of God, what you've created is a deep lesson, really a testimony about what God's image is to be. And so when you have in the one flesh a husband and wife submitting to God's plan, they become an example of ultimately how God works and how things operate in God's kingdom. Marriage is to communicate something about the image and will of God. And I believe we see that right here. Comments or questions on that before we get to our main text this morning? Go ahead, Larry.
Would you say that in the image of God would be, when I'm reading this, I'm thinking that we have a ruling power, mm-hmm. male first, women second,
mm-hmm.
over all the animals. In that image, I see the male, men being created, is that image,
mm-hmm.
a ruling power.
I think so. Yeah. And the dominion that we exercise over God's creation is a reflection of us bearing that image when nothing else in the creation does. Mm-hmm. Nick?
John 4:24 reemphasizes the fact that God is spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Since we are made in the likeness of God, spirit, we are the only of God's creation that can have that relationship not only with
mm-hmm.
God, but with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's truly the essential point.
Yes. Well, let's get to the next section. Now, turn to Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5. In Ephesians chapter 5, we have a passage that we'll refer to a few times in our study in the coming weeks. It's one of those passages that I think certainly the depth escapes me. And it points out to the reality that there is much more going on than we sometimes are able to see at first glance. Ephesians 5, I need to figure something out on my PowerPoint because something's wrong on my actions, and so I always go too far. Let's first read Ephesians 5:22-24. And we'll call on Stuart if you'll read that for us.
Ephesians 5:22-24 reads, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything."
All right, and so question number 3, what are interactions between husbands and wives designed to mirror?
The
relationship between Christ and the church. And, you know, so if God was setting up what marriage was to, the ideal situation of marriage, he was doing so in a way that reflected Christ and the church. And so the instructions given here, for example, are communicating more than just how to have an effective marriage relationship. Maybe we could look at it this way. Marriage is man's most intimate physical relationship, and it is meant to demonstrate our most intimate spiritual relationship. And so, as a husband is to his wife, so is Christ to his church. Now, what aspect of the church's relationship to Christ is emphasized here?
Wives being subject to husbands.
Yeah, submissiveness, subjection, rather. And so the way that a wife relates to her husband is to be the way that the church relates to Christ. Now, this is not a study of the subject of authority this morning, but how important is authority for the church? Is it kind of everything? Who has it all? Jesus says, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth." Matthew 28:18. It is all his. He is the ruler. He is the king. You know, he has all authority. And so, Christ is head of the church. And he says, as Christ is head of the church, husbands are to be the head of the family, the head of their wives. As the church is subject to Christ, you know, again, wives ought to be to their husbands, as he says at the end of verse 24, in everything. And again, that's pretty powerful, right? It's pretty, you know, a strong statement. Everything. Can it really mean everything? And that's how we understand it to refer to the church, and we ought to. And so here is how it sets it up. Now, when you reject this, when you reject this relationship of husbands and wives, you're not just rejecting a method that might describe a household. What are you rejecting?
The ordinance of God.
The ordinance of God. The will of God. The image of God. A denial of this relational aspect of marriage is a denial of the very image that we were created as beings created in the image of God, and it is a rejection of God himself. There's a recent article in NBC, on NBC.com, written by a PhD who works with Stanford in some capacity, named Marcy Bianco. And she's talking about this idea of patriarchy. You know, which of course, by the way she refers to it, it's really male oppression. And here's a quote from the article. "Patriarchy is at its most potent when oppression doesn't feel like oppression, or when it is packaged in terms of biology, religion, or basic social needs like security, comfort, acceptance, and success. Women are questioning patriarchy, heterosexuality, that has kept them blindly." I guess I accidentally cut off part of that quote. Let's see if I have it in here. "That has kept them blindly subordinate for centuries." And so here is one way of referring to this, I guess we'll call it traditional role of wives needing to submit to their husbands. Carl?
Yeah, at its heart, right, in a society that has already rejected the idea of God and rejected the idea of the image of God and the authority of God, then what she's saying is perfectly in line.
That's right. And so this mentality is a rejection of the image we were created. You know, and that's what it is. You know, when you start to tamper with the foundations that God has established, again, you're not just alternating a way that something could be done or should be done. You're rejecting God's plan and the image we were created in. And of course, if you don't want to submit to God, if you see submission to God as oppressive, then you're going to see a relationship that is designed to reflect how God is to relate to his people, how God relates to his church. Of course, you're going to see that as oppression as well. But we're talking about the image of God here.
But you know, when people write articles like that, I'm always looking at everything they put in that. You use the word religion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion,
yep,
could be anything, you know. And so they, when they use the word religion, they can say, well, I can do this my way. You don't have to
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so often the world got what they think religion is, spirituality, or religion is godliness. You know, they're all kind of.
And you know, earlier in an earlier class, we pointed out that a belief in evolution ultimately believes that evolution is just of the imagination of man. I will say, I have a feeling she had a very particular religion in mind. Maybe two, you know, maybe three. I don't know for sure, but I'm sure to her it's Christianity, probably Islam. But again, you know, the way she states it, again.
That's their concept.
It's not truth at all. And this was actually in an article about, homosexual expression, you know, and how empowering some people are who are bold and blunt about that expression. I think Carl?
Yeah, just every relationship you feel like oppression. I mean, you know, most teenagers, probably a lot of teenagers, probably feel oppressed by their parents.
Mm-hmm.
They have to subject themselves to that authority, and to tell you the truth, you know, what was talked about in Ephesians 5:22, if the attitude of the one to whom the other is submitting is not Christ-like, then it can very well be oppressive.
And it could be very difficult.
And mm-hmm. it can be very difficult, and the wrong. And a lot of the responsibility for that situation, and the wrongness for that, it falls on the one who is the oppressor.
Yeah, and we'll get to what God says to him as well. But here's the point. God created this part of a relationship to communicate something about him. And so here I am in that sort of position, and it's not easy in my mind. And again, maybe the reason I think that is the case is because the leader is not leading. What am I to do in that situation, right? Well, I'm to still live up to the image that God created me in. Now I think we have Ben, then Larry, then Nick.
The quote that you have up there, she focuses on oppression and patriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are patriarchy is just a loaded term in our society
mm-hmm.
today. Oppression is something that emanates from the oppressor.
Mm-hmm.
Submission emanates from the person who's submitting mm-hmm. himself. It is a self-submission.
Mm-hmm.
It is self-control and a decision. And when I teach the young people's class, or any time I have any influence over, especially young ladies, to me it's not whether you love the person you're going to marry. You look down the road, can I submit to the person he is? Because if he's not going to get better, the only way he's going to get better is by God's will.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't want to submit to that person, then don't marry them. Because it's not going to get better if they are an oppressive type person.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that's God's will. Even if you're not in a godly man, you have to do your part. And in the church, we have to help, the men here have to help each other to be better husbands
mm-hmm.
and study things like this and talk amongst ourselves
mm-hmm.
for that reason.
Yes. Thank you. Larry?
Isn't that what Titus is talking about in the book of Titus?
Titus chapter 2 for sure.
Mm-hmm. We all have something to say about things. That's why we always do God. You know, but they always talk about the people talking on Facebook, and we always
mm-hmm.
got our opinion on it. But the main thing, the true thing is that it's only God.
That's right. Nick? All right, well, let's move on to the next. But again, thinking about this sort of mentality or these sort of feelings, the feelings to reject this order, is basically a mindset that is insisting on running in the dark. That's kind of what it is, what it's like. It's a denial of the reality of God as creator. Now, 25 through 29. Let's see. Nick, could you read that?
Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water by the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does for the church.
All right. So, what should be seen in the husband's treatment of the wife? I might.
Sacrificial love. The same love that Christ showed for the church, for everybody.
Sacrificial love, the same love that Christ had for the church. Think about what this text says alone. What does Jesus do as the husband for his church? What are some of the things that this text describes?
Love.
He loved, okay. And love, of course, love your wives as Christ loved the church. And that love was shown through sacrifice. He gave himself up for her. What else do you see?
Cleansed.
Okay. Cleansed her.
Sanctified
her. What does sanctified mean?
Set apart.
Set apart, that's right. What else did he do? Yeah, he presented to himself the church in all her glory. Having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So he loved and sacrificed, he sanctified and cleansed, and he presented her in her glory. Presented her to himself in her glory.
That's that sacrificial love, uh-huh. In that someone else may be the benefit of your actions.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, again, you think about glory, you know, which very much John 13 is about glory that we studied this morning. Glory that was shown when Jesus was at the feet of his disciples, right? That was Jesus lifting up his servants, and you know, so here we have the husband as he relates to his wife, whose glory does Jesus pursue? It's his bride's glory. So here we have instructions for the husband. And the husband is to have Jesus' sacrificial love as the model for his love. So is the husband the head of his bride? Absolutely. But as he leads by the example of Jesus' leadership. Jesus' leadership is best shown by going to the cross for the glory of the church. That was how Jesus led. He did whatever it took to benefit his bride. He acted in the best interest of his bride. He led while loving. Do we see example? Oh, go ahead, Nick.
I would say that while an individual, a man, may consider that he's keeping the law and doing the things that God would have him to do, if he does not show this sacrificial love for his wife, he's being disobedient to God. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that a lot of people comprehend that today. Because they say, oh, you're kowtowing to your wife, or look at him fawning to his wife, and look at her submitting to him. They make fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
When in essence, building up your wife in love is showing obedience to God.
Mm-hmm.
And we should glory in that. We should be happy in that.
If the wife submitting to her husband is meant to reflect the church submitting to Christ, you know, how might we describe what the husband's love for his wife is meant to demonstrate? It's meant to demonstrate the feeling, you know, and more, again, more than a feeling, but the feeling of Christ towards his church. You know, so if marriage and how the wife submits to the husband reflects the image of God and the will of God, even more so, you have the love of a husband reflecting again the image, the character, and will of God. And you know, we should not be okay with again, we'll just say feminist movements, you know, and again, speaking of God's design as oppressive and again, just patriarchy and whatever sort of, you know, term that might be thrown to it. And you know, we should stand against that. But in the same way, we have to stand against any sort of demonstration of a husband, portrayal of a husband, that isn't striving to mirror the love that Christ had for the church. You know, I mean, again, those are two fundamental realities about the image of God that he wants to be expressed in marriage. And both of those are problems in marriage today. And again, both of them are a big deal. How did Jesus lead? He did not lead, you know, by dominating or meeting his own self-centered interest. Jesus came to serve. Comments or questions on that? Again, we will talk more about these some in future lessons, but anything else before we continue?
In 1 Peter, it talks about giving honor to the weaker vessel, talking about the wife. Mm-hmm. And it says that your prayers may not hinder.
Mm-hmm.
So people don't realize that you treat your wife bad. Well, you have to consider how your communication with God.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're not treating your wife right, then if you go to God, your prayers will say be hindered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, again, if we move away from the image from which we are created in, the image of God,
mm-hmm.
If we're no longer walking as children, that's going to have spiritual ramifications for
that's
us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Nick?
There are many people today who would take offense at the word weaker vessel,
mm-hmm.
thinking that it meant inferior.
Mm-hmm.
It does not mean inferior.
Mm-hmm.
Has a different purpose.
That's right.
And we need to recognize that something as fragile is not inferior. So we need to.
It communicates value.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll go to the final section of Ephesians 5. And this started at the end of verse 29. If you want to just read all of verse 29, whoever reads it, that'll be fine. We'll call on Carl, if you could read that. Ephesians 5, 29-33.
Just as the Lord does the church. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery. But I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband.
Right, and so now as we're starting to wrap up this great text, what passage is Paul quote in verse 31?
Genesis 2:24.
Again, we talked about this in our last class. We talked about that passage. When you read Genesis chapter 2, verse 24, do you see Christ in the church in that passage? That's not what I would have first seen. You know, we rightly talked about marriage last class. You know, Genesis 2:24 teaches us something about marriage. Well, here, Paul says it's actually referring to Christ in the church. Like, what? He calls it a great mystery. mystery in the New Testament isn't like we might think of as a mystery novel, you know, where you sort of read through and there are clues that are kind of dropped. Mystery refers to something that cannot be known unless it is revealed. And so, I emptied my pockets just a little bit ago of everything but one item. Do you know what it is? Might guess keys or wallet. Phone. It is a green pea. You would not have guessed that, would you?
No.
Well, it was a mystery. You know, there's no way you could have known. Unless the one who has control of the information makes it known to you. I actually, in a Bible class about a week and a half ago, made the mistake of doing the same illustration when I had my wallet in my pocket. And the young man goes, a wallet? Like, well, you're right. Okay, well, I need to make sure the next time I do that illustration, I make it more obscure. But anyway, the point is, what was in Genesis 2, verse 24, and its reference to Christ and the church, is not something that we would have figured out on our own. We needed God to tell us. But this is what God is bringing to our attention. Again, what we studied in creation and what we think about marriage are all communicating something more than just what marriage is all about. It is about Christ and his church. It is about the image, plan, and will of God. You know, marriage is more than trying to meet my needs. Now, it certainly should meet my needs. Marriage is more than about creating a family. Now, again, it certainly is about family. But marriage is ultimately about Christ and his church. Let me ask if any of you, I think I had that slide out of order. Let me ask if any of you have heard of this book, Love and Respect. Any of you own that? I do. It's a good book. It's a good book. So again, don't take this as anything negative about this book. It's a very common marriage, you know, working on your marriage book. And if you look closely on the cover, the premise, again, is based on Ephesians 5:33. And the idea is man's greatest need is to feel respect, and woman's greatest desire is to feel love. And so if the man works on loving his wife and the woman works on respecting her husband, then a marriage can be fixed. If you look closely again up here, it says the love she most desires and the respect he desperately needs. You know, and so this guy conducts marriage seminars, and you know, if you read his book, you'll learn he has lots of successes too, right? And he's basing that on Ephesians 5:33. You know, here is this passage that says, you know, husbands need to love their wives, and that's because it's what she desires. And women need to respect their husband because that's what he desperately needs. And you know, we have books like that, you know, His Needs, Her Needs. And to us, the way that we think about marriage, that's what marriage is about. And again, there are lots of helpful books that give you good, sound counsel that can help us in our relationships. Yet the focus needs to be placed not just on those sort of things, meeting my needs. They need to be placed on what God wants to accomplish in marriage. You know, the church becomes one body with Christ as husbands and wives become one body with each other. And so God was showing us something there that was, again, more profound than just the needs that I feel need to be met. Carl?
So is the implication there is it verse 31 when it quotes Genesis 2, that it's taking Genesis 2 as basically a prophecy of the incarnation?
I don't see it as the incarnation as much as...
Christ coming to save us. Leaving uh-huh. heaven, coming to be...
I'd have to think about that more.
Okay, to become uh-huh. man for the purpose of saving us and glorifying us.
Mm-hmm.
Incarnation mm-hmm. in that way.
Yes, uh-huh. And really just the two becoming one flesh,
yeah.
That passage was pointing to God's greater scheme of redemption.
Yeah.
So...
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely intended by God as instructive.
Yeah.
From the beginning of time when he ordained the marriage relationship, that was teaching us what the relationship between Christ and the church was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he's making as his mm-hmm. point here.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was prophetic or not, it has been instructive for millennia.
Descriptive of what God was doing, absolutely. Now, question six, what does this passage reveal about God's purpose for designing marriage? How did you answer that? Nick?
Provides a structure for the relationship and also a commitment to one another.
Okay. It does that. Not what I'm looking for. Wasn't what I was looking for, but, you know, I'm not a great question writer. marriage needs to be about the glory of God, is what I see. Now, it gives instructions. It tells you how things should work. But what God wanted to accomplish in marriage is more than what we might first think of in accomplishing in marriage. And you think about that. Marriage, again, communicates the way God feels towards his people. And it shows that in positive ways. This is how Christ loves his bride. What does it say about when the bride is unfaithful? We can think about this. You know, marriage is about the glory of God. It's about the feelings of God he has towards his bride. Is there a book in the Old Testament about an unfaithful spouse? You remember what book it was? Hosea?
Hosea is one, but there are lots.
Yeah, there's lots of imagery, there's lots of illustrations of it, but Hosea is about that. Hosea is when his people are unfaithful to him, it's like a man who loves his wife and the wife refuses to stay faithful to him. And you see the heartache and emotion, you know, again. So in that broken marriage that Hosea was in, you see the pain that God is in when we break our relationship with him, you know. And, you know, the inverse is true. You know, when everything is beautiful and they're one and there's joy, you know, that's illustrating how God feels towards his people. And again, these are some of the ideals that we have to have in our mind. When my role becomes difficult to do, I need to ask myself, what does God want me to accomplish as a husband? What does God want me to accomplish as a wife? And I'm going to think about God's glory in this. You know, love her when he's easy. Love her when it's not easy. Respect him when it's hard. And I'm going to do this because of God's glory. And that's what I'm trying to accomplish. I'm trying to line my goals up behind his goals and objectives so that he gets the glory. How much time do we have, Harper?
1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. So, question number seven. List reasons why people get married. You can just... We'll have a blurt out moment, if that's okay. Just go ahead and say some things you put down.
All the wrong reasons.
All the wrong reasons. You couldn't say it better. Companionship, security, love, status, sex, financial, stability... Relationship problems, have a family, so you don't have to date anymore. I put Christie's for looks. You know, that's why she married. No, we could go on. There are a lot of reasons why people get married. And Christians will marry for many of the same reasons, but God's desire, God's glory, should impact that decision. We'll go ahead and stop there. And we'll pick up Wednesday on schedule with the next lesson.